Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Reservations. I am Jeremy Blair.
And I'm Rain Whalen.
And this is season 8.
Season 8.
Man. Season 8.
Can you believe that we've done 8 seasons so far?
Sure. The seasons don't mean anything.
They really don't. They really don't.
They're like the points on Whose Line Is It Anyway. They're all made up and they mean nothing. So,
But it's also helpful for us to kind of categorize everything, I guess.
Sure. I agree.
Like, you know, that season we did that. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of cool, you know. You know, in 2 more years, we'll be up to like season 15.
Yeah.
Because, well, truth be told, season 7 is the only one that took about a year to do. Because let's see. The first episode of season 7. Hang on. Stop yelling. Oh, my God.
I'm not yelling.
So our Good Morning episode premiered March 9th of 2022.
Wow. Yeah.
So it took virtually a whole year to get through season 7.
That's a while.
Yeah. But at least it won't take that long to get through this season.
No, this one will be comparatively a shorty, you know?
Yeah. So Jeremy, since this is your season to start us off with, remind the people what we're doing this season.
Okay. So we have decided to each pick one director and then go through some of their filmography back and forth until the end of season series. I have chosen Fritz Lang, which is what's going to kick off our season with today's episode. Rain, you picked Tim Burton.
I did.
So
even though... truth be told, I was like, who could I have picked? I almost went with Lynch. But the problem is we've already done a couple of his movies.
Yeah.
We've done Eraserhead and Mulholland Drive.
Ooh, those are good ones too. So it's...
Well, I mean, I could have replaced those with Wild at Heart. And
oh, that's true.
A Straight Story, but it's too late. We've already told people doing Tim Burton.
Yep. So can't take it back now. So I chose Fritz Lang, and today we are starting with Destiny, 1921. This movie is 102 years old.
That's wild, man. You know, when you really sit and think about it, over 100 years ago, people were going to the movies to watch this for the first time.
And then when you watch it, you go, oh, yeah, this movie was made 102 years ago. And we'll get to that. So cards on the table. OK, we understand. All right. There is shoddy at best representation of other cultures and their people in this movie, played by white Germans. I read a little bit about it. It at the time, of course, they're not being mean, right? These aren't, you know, I'm making fun of these groups. However, they are pretty
stereotypical.
Especially when we get to China, that's the one that's basically propaganda, especially anti-China propaganda. And there's a word for it. We're gonna get there. So, before we get to the synopsis, which I may make you do, I haven't decided. What did you think? This is the first time watch for both of us, by the way.
I was just about to ask. So I went into it kind of a little bit reminiscent of our Phantom Carriage episode. Which, of course, you know, if anyone needs to know how much we love Phantom Carriage, go back and listen to Phantom Carriage. We both loved it. This one was different, you know. I didn't hate it. Because the only Fritz Lang movie I've seen is another one we'll do this season, which I don't want to spoil.
And Metropolis, which we have done also.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so I didn't hate it. The thing that took me out of it was the depictions of the different cultures.
Sure.
But I chose to look at it as he did this as a way to connect it back to the main story.
Right. Three of these actors are sort of non-negotiable, need to be in these stories for the visual language of the movie, right? Which is pretty much predominantly what we absolutely need for this medium at this time, right? It needs to visually make sense and visually work for the whole story to come together, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, three of these actors are sort of, they need to be there, right? The other ones, you probably could have found someone, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But again, that didn't make me hate it. Like, because unlike the Phantom Carriage, where the Phantom Carriage does sort of have a downer of an ending, this one has more of a hopeful ending. Well, not really hopeful, a really good happy ending in a way. So yeah, I didn't hate it. I may need one more watch again, but yeah. So what did you think, my man?
I think I really, really liked it. I think I loved it because, again, I kind of compartmentalized like you did with this stuff. Cause again, it's, you know, this may just be cause I've never experienced, you know, being a marginalized person or been a victim of any sort of negative depictions or negative stereotyping in my expense. But I try to compartmentalize it with, it needs to be like this for the story. Yes, some of this stuff is sort of not okay, you know, but and then you have to keep reminding yourself it was 102 years ago, you know? Literally over a century ago. So keeping that, you know, sort of separated in my mind, I loved it. I thought it was great. I guess we can jump into the synopsis and then we'll jump into the analysis because it's a lot more, it's richer and more dense than I was expecting it to be.
I agree.
And I'll do the synopsis. You don't have to worry. Nah, you don't have to worry about it.
Well, I mean, but you do it when I start the season. So
that's true. Do you want to try?
Sure, I'll do it.
Okay.
All right. So Destiny, as Jeremy said, 1921 from Fritz Lang. It is a story of a young couple traveling to just a small village. It's unnamed, right? The village.
Yeah.
So yeah, they're just probably traveling for a holiday and they pick up a stranger along the way who, unbeknownst to them, is the actual incarnation of Death. He is Death in human form. And one night while the young couple's at a bar, the young man mysteriously disappears and come to find out he's dead. And so the woman pleads with Death to bring her lost love back to life. And he said he can if she can save one of three lives that are about to be lost. She unfortunately cannot. So he gives her one more chance to trade with a life that hasn't been lived yet. I'm assuming he probably meant pure soul. To trade with her lover, and he will bring him back to the land of the living. And the pure soul that she finds is a baby. But she realizes that if she hands this baby over, she would be putting the baby's mother in the exact same position she is in. So she decides to offer her own life. And death accepts, and her fiance get to be in the afterlife together, happily ever after. And that's destiny.
Good job. So we should say that in each of these instances that she tries to ford off death, in these three instances, they are taking place in different places and even different places in time, which is really interesting. These aren't all 1921 era times, which is really fascinating. We'll get to that. But the first one is in the Middle East during Ramadan. The second one is in Venice, Italy, and the third one is in China, ancient China.
Yes.
And again, being put in these situations where she's trying to save the one that she loves from death in different circumstances, and then, of course, she can't. So, okay. I have things written down.
Okay, good.
We can talk real quick just about the aesthetic and the style of this thing. So, again, this is 1921. This is a German film, and with that comes German Expressionism, which we have talked about before, years ago. Probably during our noir episode. Because this is the precursor to noir. And
yes, I believe we did, because you explained how German expressionism, you know, like they actually painted, you know, shadows on the walls.
And we see a little bit of that in the at the pub or whatever place that they're in. We can see a little bit of that painting on the walls, and even the staircase to the entrance to there is sort of bizarre looking, right? It's sort of just stylistic and in ways impractical, right? Not so much like Caligari or something a couple of years before then, or the year after with Nosferatu, right? Those things are very stylistic and hyper German expressionistic. This said, just a little bit of here and there's, and in each, I loved this little piece of details in each of these three stories. I don't know. I guarantee you they probably didn't do this then. But I love, in at least this iteration of this movie, they change the font on the title cards and on the dialogue cards to match where they are. So in the first one, it's almost it looks like Arabic, but it's still German, so the audience can still read it. And then the other one is it's you know just like italicized basically. And then the second one looks like Chinese characters, or the third one looks like Chinese characters, which is, I really liked that little detail.
It really, it did solidify, like, to show like, hey, we are telling a different story just momentarily.
Yeah.
This is where we are.
I'm trying to think of which one I liked the most. It did. Well, okay. So it did take me to the second one to realize that, and this is probably embarrassing to admit, but it took me the second time to realize that the love interest in each story is the same guy, is her fiance.
No, I mean, it took me a second too. 'Cause like I noticed it in the, in the first story. I was like, that guy looks a lot like the fiance.
Yeah.
I was like, it's probably nothing. And then the second one I was like, oh, it's because it is.
Right. Yeah. Which I love. Again, what we were talking about in the beginning. In this, the specific way the story needs to be told, and in the way we need to convey to the audience that that she truly is trying to save these people's lives, right? Mm-hmm. That we need her to really care, right? And we need the audience to care, right? So it can't be just random people every time, because who cares, right? We're going to lose interest. So to have these same actors play these different people, right? Mm-hmm. For the woman, it makes total sense for her to, of course, be the woman each time, right? Mm-hmm. But it's especially, I don't want to say, it's smart, I guess. I don't know. I did just kind of be a better way to say that. More effective. There we go. It's more effective also to have the person she's trying to save every time be played by the actor who plays her fiance, right? Mm-hmm. The person she's trying to get back at the end of all of this. And of course, death is sprinkled in there each time as well, which I really, really liked. In each of these, more so the bookends, the first and the third, are hard to get through.
Yeah.
Now, I think I couldn't even tell you how far you would have to go back for people not to even notice. But for us, definitely now, it's hard to try to get over it, you know, that these white Germans are playing Middle Easterns and they're playing people from China and they're, you know. But how excited were you that in the Venice one, he was black for real? How excited? I was so excited. I was like, oh, thank God, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I was.
Yeah. Cause it took me a second in the first story to realize that's what was happening. I was like, oh. And then as it was getting closer to the end, I was like, oh.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the final story, I was like, oh, dear God.
Yeah.
But yeah, when her friend, I'm just going to refer to him as a friend.
Sure.
Yeah, when he comes up and he's actually black, I was like, oh, thank God.
Oh, thank goodness. Yeah, I was pretty excited because I looked real hard and I was like, please, please, for the love of God, you know, because that's full body makeup, if not, and that's a problem. And we're fine. And of course, that one is less of a problem, right? The second story, because they're doing is playing Italians now, and that's who cares, you know? Now here's what's fascinating about these three stories. Okay. Is like I alluded to in the beginning, is that they take place in different times, right? He's not saying save these people who are about to die right now, right? These people have already, in the context of the story, it's as if death lives outside of time. All of these things are happening all at one time for him, right? Which is very interesting. And I don't know if they meant for it to be that way, or if they just wanted a story to take place in ancient China, in the Borgias ruled Venice, Italy, or this place in the Middle East that is not contemporary of the time. It's not ancient Middle East, but it's definitely not 1921.
Yeah. I mean, if that's what Fritz Lang's goal was, then then props to him. Because, I was like, so it reminded me a lot of, and I'm going to make a reference to something I know you'll actually like and not be mad at me for bringing up, can't think of his name, but the show Watchmen. Mm-hmm. And when we get that whole episode from Dr. Manhattan's point of view, and for him, time is happening all at once.
Right.
And he's just experiencing it in those specific moments. And so,
powerhouse episode. Good job.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was it a god walks into Abar?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, it's her last name.
It's her last
name. Anyway. But that's what it kind of reminded me of. If that's what Fritz Lang's full intention was, is like, yes, death is beyond time. And so for him, you know, maybe for for the woman, these people have been dead for, you know, years, but for death, they are about to die.
Right.
You know.
Or so, we could think of it this way, that, you know, yes, he's very worn down and he's very tired of this whole thing about being death. He doesn't enjoy it. He doesn't like it, which is why he's giving her this chance in the first place. But you could think of it also as, let's give her this unwinnable task. These people are already dead, right? These people have already died years and years ago.
Or,
so let's prove to her that death is inevitable and there's nothing you can do about it.
Right. Okay. You know what? I like that. I was about to say, you know, because I'm trying to tie it back into the title of the movie, Destiny. Mm-hmm. What if it was more of like a situation of, you know, he was going to give her a chance to maybe save these people, but they were always going to be destined to die, which is essentially what you just said, but I like how you said it better.
It's not, it's unwinnable, right? Mm-hmm. Like the whole lesson she learns is that death is inevitable and there, you can't beat it, right? There's nothing you can do about it. If it's your time, time.
Shout out to the newest episode of The Last of Us, because they talk about that.
Do they?
That episode.
I haven't watched it.
Oh, you haven't watched it? Oh, see, that's why I didn't say anything. Because like, maybe he hasn't seen it.
If anyone
has seen the latest episode of The Last of Us, shout out to that episode. The episode is toit. But yeah, I completely agree. I think this is, maybe this movie was the precursor, because we've seen this sort of trope before of people trying to beat death or bargain with death or, you know, something. When I was doing my research for the movie, I read that this was a huge influence on Ingmar Bergman's Seventh Seal, which I still really desperately want to see.
Yeah, it's good.
So my point being is I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah. And so I think I lean more towards he's giving her an unwinnable task, which makes the time period make more sense. Although I do enjoy thinking of death living outside of time. Like, you know, it's all happening at the same time.
But at the same time, why couldn't it be both? You know, because
you're right.
Why, you know, he specifically chose these three for her. So what if he already knew she's not going to be able to change anything?
Well, and I these love people, the stylistic choice of the candles for people's lifelines. I really, really like that. It's a cool visual. An exclusively visual medium at this point.
Well, and you know, it's almost like his realm. That's what it is. It's, you know, because all it is just candles. So, I love that too. And that each time when someone died, the candle went out. Even though even though I started the episode saying that, like, I didn't hate the movie, I mean, there are things about it I loved. Like, and that's one of them. That's something I loved so much about it, is that all these stylistic choices that Fritz Lang chose, like the candles, the essentially like dark cathedral he lives or resides in. I wouldn't say lives in, he just resides in. And I like that he never puts death in any sort of makeup. He just looks like a man.
Yeah.
Which is something I really love, because, you know, most film and TV, you know, when you see death, it's either a skeleton or...
Which we still kind of get, because it's at the top of his cane or staff. Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah. That full-bodied skeleton at the top. Of his staff, which I also liked. You know, it was also alluding to who he was without telling us yet.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you this, because I was hoping maybe you could supply context to it.
Let's see.
What was the whole point of introducing us to the mayor, the notary, the schoolmaster?
Yeah.
I don't really see how that had any really bearing on the plot, besides the fact that Death wanted to buy the land adjacent to the cemetery.
Yeah. It's introducing us to sort of almost like the council of elders of this town, right? The people who were in charge of everything. They have allowed this being because they have to know, I think they do know who he is at some point, and they allow him to have that land. And God, dude, that set of the wall, it's so cool. Yeah
it really is.
It's just massive, this thing. Or it's great force perspective. Either way, good job.
Yeah.
Speaking of force perspective, there was a shot. I'm trying to remember which story it was, but it was so cool. The force perspective that made it look like it was like this big, huge field, or this like it was going on for miles, and it wasn't, but it was very well done. It might have been the Middle East, maybe.
Maybe. Well, you know, I did wanna talk about the technicality of it, the kind of like we did with the Phantom Carriage, because, dude, the ghosts part was so cool. I was like, God, that's so rad, man! Like, how the fuck did they do that?
And that's when she finds out that her fiance died, because he was the last one.
Yeah.
To go into the wall.
Like, but I was just like, that's so fucking rad, dude.
I know. It is so cool.
But, you know, I just had this brain blast as we were talking about it. That adds to the theory of death being beyond the realm of time, because one of the ghosts is like a king who doesn't look like he should be there.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't look like he's from 1921. He looks more like he's from... Like, it's the 1700s.
This is going to sound jokey, and it is, I guess, but he kind of looks like the king in Disney's Robin Hood, but in human form.
So you're saying he looks like Prince John?
Yeah. Yeah, he kind of does a little bit.
Dude, shout out to the animated Robin Hood movie. I fucking love that movie.
Yeah, it's great.
When Ashley and I were at Disney, when we were at Epcot, in front of the Epcot ball, which I was telling you about, they have a thing called the World's, World Showcase. And it's meant to showcase different cultures, different worlds. And a lot of the cast members are from that area.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the UK area, one of the buildings has Peter Pan's shadow on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Which I clocked instantly. But then on the other side of this same building behind the bushes is Robin Hood and Little John. And it's from the animated. And I was so excited. And I told Ashley, like, you're going to take a picture with me in front of it. Like, because I just love that movie so much. Anyway.
Sorry, Zach.
Yeah, and I could see it. Yeah, he did definitely look like Prince John. All he needed was like his ears to be flattened from the
from the crown.
From the crown.
This was what time? This was 10 o'clock, right? 10 p.m. Because I like this act structure that it was I wrote this down too. That the town crier is letting us know what time it is by the hour. And it's 10 p.m., 11 p.m., and midnight. And there are, like, superstitions with or cultural I would just have to see superstitions within each time, right? And, of course, when the ghosts are going to that garden behind the wall, it's 10 p.m., and that's when she finds out that he's dead, right? There was something about 11 p.m. also, and then, of course, it ends at midnight, right?
Yeah. I'm going to be honest. I must have missed that.
That's okay.
I do remember paying attention to when the town crier shows up because, you know, time also plays a big deal in the bet that she has with death. Because at 11, he tells her you have 1 hour left to find me someone who hasn't had, who has days left in, you know.
Yeah.
And so she has a full hour.
Right.
But yeah, I honestly couldn't tell you the superstitions. Now, I do know one of my favorite bits, but it doesn't work here because I was, while you were talking about it, I was like, maybe it was that. My favorite bit of like old wives' tale is like the witching hour.
Mm-hmm.
But the witching hour is between, I think, like 2 and 3 in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
So I was like, no, it's not it.
Not in this case. Okay, I talked about that. I started looking at my notes. Talked about that. we can... I mean, there's a few things I found while looking up some stuff about this movie. One of them is I came across this word... called Orientalism.
Okay.
Which plays a big part in Fritz Lang's career before and after this movie. And it's a sort of way of showing and depicting the Orient. Or what they would call the Orient, in your films. Not necessarily in a negative way. It's not a negative, not necessarily a negative word or a negative phrasing, this Orientalism. It's more like you are representing this group of people in your art or in your films or in your music. And of course he does that here with the first and third. And his wife at the time, who he had divorced, because she had an affair with an Indian man. She was obsessed with Hinduism and with the Middle East and with all of that. And so she helped him write all of his movies up until 1933. She co-wrote everything with him. And so I feel like in these three stories, I think this was her biggest impact in the storytelling. Cause again, she was obsessed with these places. That, by the way, And again, it's because I'm so stupid. Because I would think you would have very little knowledge about other countries and other cultures in 1921, because where are you going to find it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how, and in what context, and in what way are you going to find all of this information without traveling? And maybe they travel, I don't know. But it's, again, it's respectful. It's not, I mean, they knew what Ramadan was, you know?
Yeah.
Which is, to me, fascinating. But because I'm just so used to living in this world where I can just type in Middle Eastern holy days, and then Ramadan will pop up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I will say that that was really interesting, because you're right. You know, in 1921, you know, they, you know, it's such a cliche thing to say this, but, you know, they didn't have access to the internet. So it is like, okay, well, how did you find out about this?
But again, it's because I'm stupid and I don't know, because I'm sure there, if I were to ask them, they'd be like, it was super easy. All I had to do was read this. You know what I mean? If I was interested in it, I would find a book about it, right?
Yeah.
And I would read, like, about it.
Do you not have books in the future?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I just don't know how to read. Yeah.
Imagine saying that to Fritz Lang. Like, yeah, like, we have books in 2023, okay, but I don't know how to read, all right?
Yeah.
And he's like, but you watched my movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I just kind of guessed at what was going on.
No, but yeah, I was just gonna say that probably is what happened, is they probably, you know, visited,
especially since his wife was very interested in these places and this culture, and she apparently found them very attractive, so as well.
And so I,
you know, that's probably what happened, but I just thought it was interesting and something to bring up to us who are very, I guess, ignorant to how they would find out all this information, which is so easy for us now.
I mean, no, I see what you're saying. And for them to use certain
words, because if, and it's got to be because the German word for it was in the thing, is infidel. Like, how did you know that word? Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, true. Good job. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I know. Man. I mean, that's the thing with doing movies that are over 100 years old, you know, like we did with The Phantom Carriage, you know, it's like, how did you know this? You know?
Right. Yeah.
But again, I think it's because, you know, we're so privileged that, like, wait, how do we know that, you know, yeah. I'm sure it's something very easy that they just probably,
something so simple, and I'm just being,
they probably had a friend who was like, oh yeah, you need to read this, or mm-hmm. you know, but I mean, but who knows, you know, they may could have seen, you know, well, I was gonna say seen a film, but, you know, 1921. Well, no, there probably would have been a movie.
No, there were. And I'll give you a good example. So another good example of Orientalism, which I'm hoping I'm saying that correctly, is The Sheik, which came out the same year. Not Middle Eastern people playing Middle Eastern people in a forbidden love story. That was very popular. If you Google The Sheik, it'll pop right up, and it was very popular at the time. So this isn't sort of like a centralized thing to just Fritz Lang or just his, you know, his co-writer wife or even Germany itself. There are so many different types of it in so many different places. If you Googled it like I did, it broke it down to, German Orientalism, you know, British Orientalism, you know, it was a hot topic of art depictions back then, I guess.
Do you think it was because maybe because since there was more than likely a language barrier, they didn't know how to go about asking these cultures to, like, hey, we'd like to have you in our film, you know?
No, and I don't think that's it. I think it's just as simple as, well, you know, we're interested in this culture and in this place, this country, this whatever. Let's just depict it in our movie, and let's not. It was never a question, I don't think, about do we need these people to represent themselves. I don't think that was a part of the conversation at all, because I don't think they were doing it to be mean. Right? They're not. They're doing it just to serve their story.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I thought of when we get to the final story in ancient China is I thought of one of my favorite games is BioShock Infinite. And if Zach has played it, he'll know. Or if, who knows, maybe a different listener knows.
Do you think?
There's a story mission where you're going through the main villain's life, his fictionized life, where he fought against, in ancient China, I believe, the Boxer Rebellion. And much like a museum, they have depictions and caricatures of Chinese people. The game made it very offensive because that's what it was supposed to be, because it was supposed to be from this very horrible person's perspective. So it was very offensive. And that's what I thought of. But the whole time I was watching it, I was like, but this doesn't really seem offensive to be offensive. I think it's just offensive because I know I'm watching a white actor portray someone who's not white.
Yeah. There are things about it that could be, and again, this is without doing in-depth, you know, research, if it even exists, into, you know, intentions of Lang and his wife. I you know, part of it is their fingernails.
Yeah.
The magician and the emperor have these comically long fingernails, right? And that's sort of offensive because that's the stereotype, right? Of the time. And of course the whole eye thing, and even some of the guards, their faces were painted darker. And again, part of it might also be, you know, just a lack of knowledge. And I'm not saying they think that magic actually exists. I don't think that's what they're saying, but it's sort of like the mystical Chinaman sort of a stereotype, which is in the magician's character, is, I guess, kind of, I mean, it's all offensive, right? But I think that it's hard to say if it's intentional or not, right?
True.
The fingernails and the magic and maybe the sort of attitudes of these two characters in particular are sort of over the top, stereotypical, which may be intentionally offensive. I don't know. Right. I know that it was the most interesting story in terms of filmmaking because we have to do more literal movie magic, right? We're having to make these tricks come to life, right? Changing the magician into a cactus, riding on a carpet, right? Which isn't, I don't think, even a stereotypical Chinese thing. The levitating parchment, which I liked. The elephant was really cool, and also the the small soldiers in the box. Mm-hmm. That was incredibly well done. Especially when they were coming out of the box and they had built those giant feet and legs.
Yeah.
To make it look like they were coming. That was cool. I really enjoyed that. But that one was harder to get through than the other ones. In terms of just, you know, thinking, I'm watching something really offensive and I'm trying not to think about it so much. But then, of course, how can't you, right?
Yeah.
Now, but again, I'm trying to think of it just in filmmaking standpoints, and it's very good.
Yeah. Now, I do want to move on just because I feel like we've been spending a lot of time.
Sure. On this. But it is a big part of what makes the movie, right?
It is. But the thing that, sorry, everyone. The thing that really stuck with me, one of the things I really liked the most is that death is tired. And that's what I loved, is that he's tired of the job. But he does it because he knows it's his job. You know, like he tells her, like, you know, it was the will of God. It was his time to go. And it's my job to do that. And I just found that so fascinating just because, you know, again, it almost in a way humanizes death.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I love that he just looks like a man, you know, no makeup, no trying to make him look more like what we think death would look like.
Sure.
And I don't know. That was one of my highlights of it, is that the Fritz Lang was humanizing death.
Well, okay. And we can get into the ending a little bit because, you saw the ending as a sort of uplifting, happy, satisfactory ending, and I think you're right, but I think you could also say that, well, he just proved to her again that death is inevitable, and you can't win, right? Sure, you were reunited with the one you love, but you had to die to do it, right?
True.
And it also proves that death can't escape death either. That he, you know, it's almost like, if you want to think about it this way as well, that if he gave her these three tasks and she succeeded, there's a chance that he doesn't have to do this
anymore.
Right.
True. That's true. I didn't think about it like that.
And that, well, it's cause I'm, you know, I like sad endings. So, and so with the ending going the way it did, which again, just like Phantom Carriage, I thought we were going to get a baby dying and we didn't.
Why do you want to see
that? I don't. I just want to see if in the 1920s, if these other countries were like, yeah, we'll just kill kids on camera. I don't care, you know? And because in American filmmaking at this time, I mean, we don't have any sort of code of conduct yet. The Hays Code hasn't been created. And even when it was created, it wasn't enforced. So we don't have this code of ethics in our films yet. And so it's possible. You know, if you wanted to do something crazy like that, go for it, right? But but of course, for her character arc, she's got to understand that, yes, getting what she wants by sacrificing an innocent infant would get what she wanted, but, you know, then she would have to live with what she had to do it, right?
Mm-hmm. And then she would be putting someone else in the exact same position she's currently in.
Right. Which, again, proves to death that, you know, there's no getting out of it either. Right. It's if it doesn't happen to you, it'll happen to somebody else.
Yeah. So the reason why, because I'll go ahead and tell you, the reason why I saw the ending as sort of uplifting was because I felt like Death pitied her a little bit, especially towards the end. Because I think you're right. I fully agree with you. I think he gave her these unwinnable tasks. There's no way she was going to succeed. You know, he was fully setting her up for failure. And I think it was because he wanted to teach her, this is just the way things are. You know, people have to die. I have to be the ones to carry their souls on. But I think at the end of it, and she showed him that she wasn't willing to hand over this baby, I think he, at that moment, took pity on her and was like, okay, I'll give you what you want. I will reunite you with your love, but that means you'll have to die. And I don't know. That's what I kind
of
saw.
Which she was already willing to do anyway, because she drank all of that poison or whatever the shit it was at the apothecary. Right.
Mm-hmm.
To get to Death's realm in the first place. Right. Mm-hmm. So she was already willing to sacrifice herself anyway. That's not, you know, I think she would rather live a real full life with her fiance. And I read in different places that it's implied, or you're supposed to infer, that they're on their way to their wedding site.
Okay.
And that's why they were traveling with that lady and her fake duck.
Yeah, her fake ass duck.
Which is pretty real. Look pretty real.
Yeah. But I mean, again, that makes sense. The other reason why I saw it as more of a hopeful ending is because Death reunites them, but then vanishes. Like once he gets them to a place, he lets them be together. You know, so.
And in that same really cool double exposure style as Phantom Carriage, which is really cool.
Yeah.
To see that technique again.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I wasn't trying to defend myself. I just wanted to explain, like.
Sure. Yeah, no, you know, I completely understand.
Because, I don't know, like, where Phantom Carriage definitely, 100%, it was, you know, a very ambiguous ending, but nothing's going to change, like we talked about. And again, if y'all want more of a, you know, context of what that means, just go listen to the Phantom Carriage episode. But where this one, I was like, you know, it just feels like, it almost feels like Fritz Lang was trying to say at the end of it, you know, death isn't the end. Like, I don't know.
Well, not for them.
Not right. For them, at least. Yeah. So that's just me.
Cool. Good job.
Well, is there anything you wanted to add?
Yes, the title in German does not translate to destiny. It translates to the weary death. By the way.
Yeah. When did
which I liked.
When did they start referring to it as destiny?
I don't know. I didn't see anything about that when I was reading about it today. Or that it was important to note anywhere. You know, it just could be something as simple as it's the American title.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like the whole.
Because both titles make sense, right? It's the. Because destiny, of course, everyone's destiny is to die. Right. And then the weary death, death is trying so desperately to either reignite meaning in what he does. Right. Or try to find ways to stop doing what he does. Either way, he's tired. Right. Yeah. And that's sort of what that means too. So, either way. Right. I prefer weary death. If I'm being honest, if we're doing which title do you rather? But I don't make the rules. So.
Yeah. I mean, either one could work, you know. I mean, it's like the whole, you know, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone for American audiences and Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone.
Right.
You know.
Which is so dumb. It is. Because the Philosopher's Stone is like a real, like, mythical thing that was written about way before Harry Potter. Yeah. So, yeah, there's no such thing as a Sorcerer's Stone, right?
Yeah. Wasn't it like because they thought American audiences weren't going to... I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
I think so.
So, Jeremy, are you ready to wrap up?
I am. I liked it.
I mean, okay. Now that we've been talking, I changed mine from... I didn't hate it to I liked it as well. Because now, you know, with us talking, which is the point of this show, I do have a new kind of, not necessarily respect. That's not the word I'm looking for. But I'm seeing it differently now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. some of the more offensive stuff is still going to get hard to, you know, hard to sit through.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to get through. Yeah.
But, you know, I liked it. I'll
tell you this. In terms of a listener watching a movie for this show, Zach, it's going to be way easier than Zero Theorem to get through. So that's what I have to say about it. So I'm not going to feel bad about this one. But before we get to your pick for next week, I think each week until we get to a certain point, I'm going to give our listeners 2 weeks heads up. Cause I don't know how hard my stuff is to find, to watch. So my next pick is going to be Dr. Mabuse, the Gambler. I don't know how hard it is to find. You may have to buy it somewhere or, you know, I don't know how long that'll take for some of our viewers or listeners or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So Dr. Mabuse, the Gambler, buckle up. It's 4 hours. So,
oh my God, that's right. You know, you said that last season.
This one.
And I told you I was going to get so mad at you and I completely forgot.
Right. This one. I think is going to be a little more exciting because it's a crime drama. It's a cat and mouse chase. So a crime lord is being chased by a detective and here on we go. Right.
Right.
So yeah, that's going to be mine in 2 weeks.
Yeah, so. I was about to say, but that's not what we're doing next week.
No. Yeah.
So, next week, my first pick is actually a double feature. We have sort of touched on this movie during season one's 80s month, but we've never given this movie a full breakdown and analysis. So next week will be the double feature of Batman and Batman Returns. I absolutely love both of these movies. I think Tim was the absolute right guy to do a gritty Batman. And a little more tease for next week. He was the first one to do a gritty Batman before our boy Christopher Nolan did.
Yeah, there is nothing we could ever do to repay him for Batman because it gave us the animated series. Mm-hmm. And so for that, I mean, the debt of gratitude is unmeasurable because the Batman, the animated series is, I think, the greatest Batman iteration we've ever gotten.
Oh yeah. RIP to Kevin Conroy.
Yeah. Oh Jesus. What a loss. Cause he was incredible.
Which
I'm going to ask you this right now.
Okay.
Because I want to know if it's going to change with these rewatches. Okay.
Okay.
as of right now, where I stand, I think I prefer Return to the first one. I think I like the second one better. Now that's where I stand right now. That might change.
I've always loved next week. I've always loved Return more than the first one.
Really? Okay, so you're the same.
Again, a little bit more tease for next week. It has nothing to do with my dislike of the first Batman movie. I love the first Batman movie, but it does start to drag. And Return is just so laser focused. It's so good.
And then Michelle Pfeiffer's,
you know, our first live action at, well, no, I'm sorry. Our first live action since the Adam West Batman, this really dark version of Catwoman.
Yeah.
Even though she fucking hated that suit, but we'll save that for the actual episode.
And get ready for, I think, the most Christopher Walken season we've ever done.
That's right.
So buckle up, guys.
That's right.
So get ready. I may try a Christopher Walken impression next week. We'll find out. All right, stick around.
Oh, man. All right. So, Jeremy, do you want to close us out?
Sure. I hope everyone tolerated us talking about Destiny. I hope you guys enjoyed the movie. Yes, there are modern-day issues with it, but I think a lot of it still holds up. Not all of it, of course. I think it still has a lot of filmmaking merits. This was Alfred Hitchcock's favorite movie, and it inspired Louise Buñuel to make movies in the first place. So it does have a legacy that goes pretty deep. So it's not without its filmmaking merits and its stamp on filmmaking history in general. Without it, we don't get Unchi and Andalou. We don't get some Hitchcock influence in his films. We don't get a lot of stuff. So good for Fritz, and we're going to keep on going, and it's going to get a little more noir every week we do one. So
hell yeah.
So it's exciting. So I hope you guys enjoyed it, and we'll see you guys next week for Batman and Batman Returns.